It's the Wonky Show. We've got a brand new Secretary of State for Education, which means it's goodbye to Gavin Williamson. We're talking categories in a sector, and there's new research about students to stay local after graduating. It's all coming up.
You know, throughout Gavin Williamson's term, it felt very much like there were lots of sort of secret, unclear agendas that, you know, he was doing with the department and leading with the department, and the sector really didn't know what was coming at them day after day, month after month, week after week, with you know, the department. And so hopefully...
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, and here to help us reshuffle the policy deck. As usual, we have three fantastic guests. On his way to Brighton, it's Andrew Hargreaves, co-founder of our friends and fellow travellers at the mighty Data HE. Andrew, your hire to the week, please.
Oh, well, great to be here, Mark. It's got to be my helicopter ride over London yesterday. Not only giving me a fantastic perspective on our great city, but obviously just be mindful of what was happening down below as I went over the streets of Westminster.
And pictures on Twitter look fantastic. And in London, it's Hilary Jebiababio, Vice President for Higher Education at the National Union of Students. Hilary, your hire to the week, please.
I'm going to cheat and do my highlights of last week because I haven't done too much this week yet, but... UUK's annual conference was good because I got to meet all of these sector heads that I'd been speaking to or lobbying at for the past year. So great to see some faces in person after a very long time.
And we met for the first time in person as well. That was a real pleasure. And somewhere deep in the wilds of Southwest England, no one quite knows where, it's Wonky's associate editor, David Kernahan. That's DK to you and me. DK, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, it does have to be Team Wonky getting together for the first time in a year and a half. And it was lovely to see all of you, even you, Mark. And, you know, it was just nice to catch up and to go from being a virtual organization to being in the same room and arguing and conversing and discussing. It was just lovely.
I can confirm it was a delight. If you hadn't said that, I was going to throw that in myself. It was so fantastic to see everyone after everything the last couple of years.
It's so
fantastic. Right. Start the week with Schrodinger's reshuffle. It finally came. Hilary took us through it.
Gavin Williamson is out, one of the big sackings of the surprise reshuffle yesterday, which was a surprise to some, not a surprise to many of us in the sector. And we're now getting used to being introduced to even Nadeem Sahawi, who is our new Secretary of State for Education, who's still going to be working with Michelle Donnellan, the Universities Minister, who's now got a promotion and now attends Cabinet. So there's lots of stuff to think about going forward, what Nadeem Sahawi's agenda is going to look like, what that's going to mean for the spending review coming up, and ultimately what the relationship between government and education is going to look like now that Gavin Williamson is gone. So lots to think about going ahead for the next few months, year. We'll see what happens.
Right. So, Andrew, do you think the sector breathing a bit of a sigh of relief on this one?
Well, that was exactly the words I used yesterday, Mark, when I was with some friends. I said that you can probably hear, not just from the sector, but the entire education sector, a sigh of relief as the country let out its air. So I suspect so. I have a tendency to not want to attack or damage public servants, but I think there's got to be a sense from across the sector that this hasn't been the best time for policy, for setting a sense of direction. And so I suspect the majority of people think this is welcome news.
And DK, there's been a few other minor changes so far. So at time of recording, we don't have the full lineup of all the ministers and their briefs, but there's been some other changes at DfE that are worth noting, aren't there?
Well, we have to talk about Nick Gibb. The long parliament of 1640 was the first four-year parliament in English history.
True fact.
And it saw Nick Gibb appointed to the schools brief at the Department of Education. There was no schools at the time, but he just hung around for a bit. It does feel like he's been there forever. He's not exactly widely liked by the education establishment because, after all, he is a conservative and the education establishment do tend to lean in the other direction. But he's been respected. He's done, I mean, by all accounts, a decent job under near impossible circumstances, and he has gone. So that was the big shocker for me. He's like a fixture and fitting at DfE.
And Michelle Donlan's been promoted to attending cabinet, which was, I don't think anyone saw coming. And there's some speculation this morning that she might be taking on an expanded role, including FE, maybe including some of Nick Gibbs' role, something like that.
Mm. You keep saying nobody saw it coming. I've been saying for weeks Michelle Donlan's going to end up in cabinet in the reshuffle.
Just not as universities minister.
There is a history of universities minister attending cabinet, but it's difficult to see why Michelle is in the cabinet unless Boris is planning a serious focus on HE and FE. So that is absolutely one to watch.
The other speculation and the other thing to watch that I'm thinking about is of course what happens with the SPADs. Now, something quite big has changed in Whitehall in the last couple of years, which is SPADs are now appointed by Number 10. And we've had Ian Mansfield working for Gavin Williamson. Ian Mansfield, sometimes of the wonky parish when he's not in government. Ian Mansfield, for Gavin Williamson, also supporting Michelle Donlan. Some speculation about whether he'll stay on or not, probably. And the informal speculation is that because he's essentially appointed by Number 10 and they want him there. And with Michelle Donlan having an expanded role, pretty much all of her kind of non-COVID stuff from the last couple of years, all the policy that's come out that has not been about COVID has been pretty much classic Ian Mansfield. I mean, it's been straight from all of our favourite white right wing educational culture warrior. I don't know how to describe him. But,
it's absolutely Mansfield's world at the moment in DfE. I mean, it is good news for him personally if he is being kept on at DfE along with Angus Walker, who is of course Gavin Williamson's other SPAD that did the media stuff. He would, I think, find it difficult to get another ministerial support role in the current government because his CV says he was the man that supported Gavin Williamson. Not really the kind of thing you want on your CV if you're looking for another SPAD role, I would suspect.
But remember, as I say, he works for Number 10. He doesn't work for Gavin Williamson.
Indeed so.
Yeah, I'm trying to be, you know, cautious and optimistic about this new appointment. I know that Nadeem Zahawi has done a lot with the vaccine rollout, and I think largely people have viewed that quite positively. And so I'm hoping that in the same way that he was sort of open and quite constructive about how he did that rollout, I feel that at the very least, what I would hope for is an open, transparent, renewed relationship with the sector, and rather than this sort of conflict-ridden approach that Gavin Williamson took during his term in office. I do hope that, you know, coming up to the spending review, he really uses that as a chance to re-engage the sector and make a mark with really trying to you know, show us his commitment to actually working with us and rebuilding higher education and education more widely in a way that actually speaks to the major concerns we've been speaking about for years. So hopefully no more Secretary of State battles and more collaboration and working together, but we won't know until he really lays out his agenda.
He does seem a more serious figure, doesn't he, Andrew?
Yes, I'd say so. I mean, as Hillary said, he's got this reputation more recently built around the vaccine program, for which he's established some personal credibility. And certainly when when I've seen him making contributions in public about any policy area, you just get a sense of a more solid, grounded individual. If I can pick up that point as well about hope, I mean, to be really candid, my biggest hope is that we get some clarity. I think ambiguity is the enemy of success, and I have to say, in this recent period, I felt we've never been through a darker period of ambiguity for the sector. And so if anything, I'd just like to see not rushed, but a clear policy direction that we can start moving to this next period with a greater degree of confidence about what it looks like not just for HE but for the broader education sector as well. So that, you know, I welcome him. I welcome his appointment. I've got a very open mind about what it might mean, and I think as a sector we should welcome a new contributor in this space and be open to that. But I do think he's got to deliver on a policy direction, because I'm not sure we can cope with much more big ticket ambiguity.
And if I may jump in on that, I think that's so important. I think, you know, throughout Gavin Williamson's term, it felt very much that there were lots of sort of secret, unclear agendas that, you know, he was doing with the department and leading with the department, and the sector really didn't know what was coming at them day after day, month after month, week after week, with, you know, the department. And so hopefully, having that clarity and having that sort of openness, which I hope that he will have, will just get us in a much more stable place about what he's trying to achieve and how we can work together to sort of, start to think about, you know, what needs to be achieved going forward. So I really hope it's not sort of a term that reflects what Gavin Williamson sort of portrayed as something that was, you know, very unclear. I remember there was a lot of, you know, press photos of him showing himself to try and like look serious, but not really telling us what he was doing. And so hopefully clarity and a clear direction, but most importantly, I think collaboration with the sector is going to be important. And I think there's a lot of relationships that need to be renewed and restarted even after Gavin Williamson's reign of insert any adjective that you would want to put there in the blank.
It bodes well as well, I think, because I mean he's reasonably well known to the sector. I mean, it, just in his most recent role as vaccines minister, there was a lot of back and forth between universities and his office, and then going back to his time as is it young people's minister, DK, or children's minister?
Yeah, it was children's minister, a role in which he was almost immediately followed by Michelle Donnellan, of course.
That's right. And then actually when he was on the Biz Select Committee, as Jim points out on the site this morning, his questioning about the Brown reforms showed that he was at least engaged and curious about how the £9,000 tuition fee might end up getting out of control for taxpayers, which actually does put Sandham apart a little bit, because that was not the prevailing sense at the time. And
it
actually
does. Hillary,
Your predecessors, sorry to interrupt, but a couple of your predecessors have said on Twitter in the last 24 hours, so I've seen both Aaron Porter and Tony Pierce say, when they were at NUS engaging, with him, that, they thought he was thoughtful and engaged and you know, easy to do business with. So I thought that was encouraging as well.
Yeah, I reckon that in the political climate that we're in, especially the one that has been created within education, at least over the past few years, having somebody thoughtful, you know, is something that is going to be so important. I think having to come up against, you know, such a political staunchness from Gavin Williamson, who funnily enough we never got a face-to-face with or Zoom call with, you know, it was hard to maneuver where we could find points of collaboration and working together, and actually it not always being sort of political sparring, but actually it looking like a productive way of speaking and moving forward in the work that we were bringing to DfE and to the minister and hopefully the Secretary of State by extension. So, you know, I hope that trait is something that he still carries with him, and I'm yet to meet him. And when I do, I'll, you know, hopefully get a better sort of gauge of who he is and what he's like. But until then, I think we're, you know, it would be a good thing to keep open-minded until he sets the tone that he wants to, you know, carry his tenure through with.
Well, if I was advising him, I would say that it's an absolutely kind of no-brainer to go and rebuild some of the bridges that have been kind of torn down under the old administration, because, you know, having a good relationship with the sectors that you work with as a Secretary of State is only a good thing. It's only going to help advance your agenda. It's only ever smart politics to do that. So, you know, you should be high on his list of people to meet in the coming weeks and months. And I do hope that the advice gets through, because I think, you know, there's clearly a lot of rebuilding work to do. DK, sorry, I cut you off there. Did you want to say something else?
I was just saying that the idea of having a minister that is focused and engaged with the detail is, I would argue, possibly a lowish bar, but it is great to have somebody coming over the top of it. I mean, there's lots of interesting stuff about Nadim Dahawi. He's been a rising star for a long time. He was tipped by the Independent as a member of the Cabinet of 2020 as far back as 1997 when he was a councillor in Wandsworth. He's done a lot of interesting stuff, not all of it entirely as respectable as the image he currently likes to portray, so I would strongly advise you to take a look at Minor Jim's article for some of his history with Geoffrey Archer, for instance.
And there's a couple of other points. I mean, as I say, the reshuffle is still ongoing, but there's a few other things to note. I think the appointment of Nadine Dorris to the culture department is, wow. I mean, I think that sort of puts the, that makes that department squarely the kind of culture war department, it seems to me, particularly with Liz Truss off to as foreign secretary, which in some ways I think is good news, because I think one of the worst kind of outcomes for the sector would have been if, you know, one of the big culture warriors had been appointed as Secretary of State for Education. So if some of that silliness is happening elsewhere in Whitehall, that's probably good news for us. Time will tell, though. Time will tell.
Time will tell.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Oh, hi, Mark. it's Jim from the team. Now, look, normally what we do at this point in the podcast is edit in a contribution from one of the people who's been writing for us from our fantastic community of contributors, someone that's been writing for us on the site. But this week, just before we get going properly with, you know, the kind of big rush of stuff into the term, I just wanted to say that I think you should write for us. That's right. You might be someone from a sector agency, you might be someone senior in a university, you might be someone junior in a university, you might be someone that works in a student union, you might be a student, someone that works in around the higher education sector. The point about Wonky is the whole thing is that we're trying to open up the higher education debate to hear from people we don't normally hear from, to get new ideas into the mix, to hear opinions that we've perhaps not heard before, fresh perspectives from people that we've perhaps not heard from before. So whoever you are, we think you've probably got a blog in you. And, you know, if you've got an idea for a blog, just drop us an email, team@wonky.com. One of us will pick it up, either me or DK or Debbie or Matt from the team. One of us will pick it up and we'll do all we can to support you with your pitch to get onto the site, to get your ideas out there and to, as I say, advance the higher education debate. So that's team@wonky.com. Really looking forward to seeing your pitches. Cheers.
Now, DK started a big conversation in the sector about how we categorise universities. There's a lot here. DK, talk us through it.
So, I mean, the way we think about the sector, the idea of pre and post 92s, the idea of the Russell Group, the idea of all the other mission groups, it's about 30 years old. It's a way of describing differences between providers that existed in the early 90s. And I would argue that there's so much has changed in the sector. I mean, not least the regulatory changes of 2017, the Higher Education and Research Act of the same year. The sector is not the same place, and yet we're still, and I know I'm still, in the visualizations I do for the site, using these labels like Russell Group and Post 92, which I'm arguing don't really mean anything anymore. I mean, mission groups are lobby groups. They are a group of providers that come together to make a particular argument, not necessarily a group that are coming together because they are similar in any way. And there's lots of providers that are not in mission groups. There are 451 providers that are regulated as higher education providers in the UK. There's a huge scale of difference. So on the site, what I've tried to do is to pull together some categories that are suitable for thinking about particular types of provider now, rather than 30 years ago. And it kind of feels like the kind of thing somebody new to the sector, like, for instance, a new minister of some sort, would find particularly helpful. So it's a consultation. It's not like I'm setting out this is the final answer. I've had lots of useful conversations with people around the sector. I hope very much, and I'm starting to have a lot more conversations with people that are interested in this topic and are interested in the way we conceptualize and talk about the sector. So it's been fascinating stuff so far, and I'm keen for other people to get involved.
Andrew, do you think that we'll be able to move this forward? Do you think we'll be able to build some consensus about a way forward with this?
Well, I suspect the short answer to that is no, but not that's only because reaching consensus is, as we all know, very difficult in our sector. I mean, can I just say I really enjoyed reading DK's articles and classifications, not least because it just prompted me to think about something which I, given we're in the data business, obviously we think about comparison groups and peer groups, etc. In data
and
analysis.
And I assume you have your own.
We way. And actually we go for a very, very... perhaps simple, and again, I don't seek consensus on this, but we think that actually this concept of reputation or status, however you want to think about that, but certainly academic intake credentials are a big part of that. And so we use a simple tariff model to help us understand that. That's not to in any way suggest there aren't other more complex variables at play. But I think you will struggle to get consensus on it. But as I said, that's not outside of the norm for the sector, because there are just so many sensitivities around what this stuff means. I think what does matter is that people do think about universities in this way. You know, they have some frame of reference, whatever that is, whether it is 30 years old or whether it's just from their own experience of attending. They tend to cluster universities together. And it's why we use the tariff model, because when we look at the data, the most common feature we can see, whether it's about mobility or whether it's about outcomes, whether it's about attainment, there's a correlation between the academic status of the student applying and where they apply to, and that there's certainly some correlation in that. So we tend to use that. But I really did enjoy just reading the classifications, getting a sense about this diversity. But doesn't it also tell that story about just how wonderfully rich and diverse for a country this size our HE system is? I mean, it really is impressive.
Yeah, it really shows that. It's fascinating. I mean, Hilary, I'm interested to know what your kind of frame of reference is when you think about different types of universities. And we've been talking a bit about how this work applies to student unions as well, and how different types of student unions exist in different types of university in often ways that are counterintuitive.
Yeah, so I try not to think too much into the whole Russell Group and post-92 groupings too much. But I think over the past year, I've sort of been forced to do so as to understand how decisions have been made and how, you know, different people have been navigating the pandemic over the past year. I do think that there's something interesting around reframing what that looks like. I think the Russell Group still sort of remains this tightly knit group that want to make decisions all together and, you know, sort of still have that backroom that they make all these decisions in, and then they press release something. And I would really welcome, you know, an approach that doesn't necessarily look at people for sort of historical legacy, because we know that even with that, there's some issues and controversies there. But I think it's important that moving forward, we think about, you know, what is the vision that the sector wants to take going forward, and how might that inform the way that different institutions, think about themselves and group themselves together and work together. I am particularly interested in how this has all played out in terms of what institutions are needing, especially given that, you know, I hear day after day from smaller specialist institutions, many of which host arts courses, how worried they are about the government agenda, to see if it will be continued, but the government agenda around low value courses and, the impact that would have on them. And I reckon there's something around that is transferable beyond looking at, you know, Russell Group or post-92 or, some of these regular descriptors that we hear that don't necessarily make sense to people that aren't within the bubble of the sector. So I'd really welcome a much more productive and fluid, actually, way of thinking about the sector, especially given that, you know, the big lesson I think the sector needs to learn going forward around this area is that, you know, if they're going to do anything, it's better that they do it together rather than in a disjointed way where they're sort of grouping themselves separately and not communicating. So I reckon that's really important.
DK, talk us through what happens next.
So we're hopefully going to be doing a range of articles on the site. I've been contacted by a load of people, including somebody who had written an entire master's level thesis on this very question. We're going to be publishing some of that. We're going to be trying to use these classifications in the data presentations that we do. So if you see Wonky talking about, say, the Russell Group as a group of institutions, we probably deserve some kind of a black mark there for not getting into the spirit of this. And we're just going to see how it plays particularly with this narrative on low quality courses, there has been a tendency in the past to think a quality university is a Russell Group university and everybody else is a bit suspicious. That's not the case. There are lots of great quality courses in the sector. And even though we seem to be moving towards using the OFS's PRECEDE metric as a way of finding them, which if you plot on one of the graphs in the article, you can see an almost perfect inverse correlation with the number of students that come from a state school background. So if all of your intake come from private schools, you're much more likely to see them stay on and do the full course and much more likely to see them get a good job afterwards. And that's not necessarily any facet of the quality of the university. So I'm just hoping we can expose some of our underlying assumptions about different kinds of providers and just look at the sector with a fresh lens.
And you can read more about that on wonky.com. Now, every week on the show, we delve deep into the sector's past to discover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's Academic Registrar, Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
Strange rules for regulating the lives of students probably reached their peak as the university started to modernise. And one of the things that brings that into sharp relief is when different kinds of people come to university. So there's a major phase after Oxford has admitted women and students have returned from after the First World War who are more mature, more engaged with the world, about how the university can control their lives. So there's a great moment where the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Oxford from 1920 to 1923 decides that he's going to ban elevenses, because he's decided that this is a frivolous thing for students to do. They shouldn't be doing this. He's going to ban them. And so he starts working out how to do that. And he gets this petition in from the women's colleges complaining that students couldn't stand the strain of going from 9 to 1 without sustenance. And he goes on to say, well, he thinks that it would probably be a good idea if they practice social austerity. But if you look at the rules that students are having to deal with in the 30s, they're just wonderful in terms of the depth. And students get this kind of panoply of bits of information telling what they can or cannot do, where they can stay, what they can bring with them, what they can do. So they're not allowed to bring a car. Now, current residents of Oxford will be delighted by the notion that it was very clear that you get a small slip of paper saying, don't bring a car to Oxford, you're not allowed. But the rules go on to set out all sorts of other things you can't do. Undergraduates will not loiter in the streets at coffee stalls or at the stage door of a theatre. They will not take the chair at any public meetings. They're not allowed to set up magazines without permission. There's a whole set of rules about not being allowed to take part in acting unless you've got permission. No one is allowed to visit any bars, strictly forbidden from going to any of the bars in the city. And there's a set of rules for how you have to organise dinner parties. Flying is not allowed without proctorial permission. You have to go and get leave before you do that. What, of course, is scary are the rules they've come up with for how to handle men and women being together. So there's a whole set of rules about the amount of chaperoning that the women members of the university, the women who've just become undergraduates for the first time are allowed. They have to have a companion approved in advance if they are to meet with a man student. And they're certainly not allowed to take them to their room. And there's a whole set of these kind of rules that work their way through. Parties of men and women undergraduates may not be held unless each woman undergraduate has previously forwarded to the proctors the written leave from the principal of her college. It is most important that academic dress should be worn. So the prospect of organising all of these things is great. Now, I thoroughly recommend Jane Robinson's Blue Stockings books, because it charts out how people actually were quietly breaking all these rules and living with them, and that not all of them were actually enforced. But there's a real tension here about how the university has decided that it is looking after people. Now, we've seen off a minister who was excited about the notion of in loco parentis. And for those of us who've looked at this kind of rule, this is what in loco parentis meant, this kind of control your students' lives, and I think we should be very glad that we're not trying to do that now.
Now, the UPP Foundation has new research about students that stay local to a university after graduation. Andrew, talk us through it.
Yes, Matt. This is, as you say, a research by the UPP Foundation on what students choose to do after graduating, with this start number of 51% of graduates remaining in their local university area. But I have to say the most poignant part for me was the call for greater data transparency. That we seem to not be alone in Data HE in calling on the people that we characterise as the data barons to be more liberal with data, so that we can understand better what's going on, and that the sector can make better decisions and choices around that data. So a really interesting research piece. But as I say, for me, the striking point being, how do we get access to more information so we can understand these patterns much better and respond more effectively?
So just unpacking that a bit, talk us through the patterns that we can't unpick with the data that we have. What do we need to collect?
Well, interestingly, I'm pretty sure the data's there, actually. I mean, I was reflecting on this in terms of, so it's not that the data's not there, it's just, is it available in a safe way for individuals? But I was reflecting on what we can see as Data HE, because we get to see that individual level provider data when we're working with them. And so that critical information about, well, not only did they stay, but where did they come from? How far did they commute? What were their qualifications when they entered? So there's something about that input data of what was the source of this individual, because I notice in this research, of course, they've got this understanding about the outcome data and where the individual's living at graduation. But I think stitching together that geographical understanding of where did I come from? Was I mobile? Did I cross one of the domestic borders? And then what did I choose to do? Because I was particularly struck by the characteristics of the four universities that were explicitly drawn out. And as Data HE, we're very aware of how the actual composition of their student body in terms of starting geography is incredibly diverse, and that will have a huge influence on whether or not they stay in the local area or not. So definitely there's something about stitching together that, where did I, you know, what was my starting position and what was my end position.
I mean, it sounds, Hillary, like that would be crucial to understand. I mean, you'd probably dream about having that kind of level of data.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting, actually. I think the more that I think about graduates, and I don't necessarily think about graduate outcomes so linearly as, you know, finding jobs, but when it does come to jobs, I do find it interesting yet unsurprising that a lot of graduates do choose to stay in their local areas, especially because, you know, throughout university, I think sometimes what we don't talk about enough is that, you know, what students do outside of the formal requirements of their course, especially in the cities, towns, areas that their institution is in, often offers them a lot of skills, a lot of connections, a lot of relationships that enable them to really, you know, figure out what they're doing going forward. And that geographical point of, you know, students staying in those cities as opposed to, you know, moving back home or going somewhere new, is a reflection of, you know, first of all, what opportunity looks like geographically. But also it's really telling to think about what students sort of perceive as, the role of university in marking out their independence and what that means for how they make decisions about their way forward. But I think it's lots of interesting data to look at, and I think it will be useful, especially the more I get to, you know, meet students, speak to students and see what they're thinking about, especially in whatever is going to come out of the pandemic era that we're in.
Mark, can I just add a point of further interest, mostly about two particular geographical areas that jump out for me. The first is Northern Ireland, because I think this work has an interesting, you know, lens on it around areas that have number controls, and we all know about the size of migration of young people from Northern Ireland. So I think there's not just a, you know, there's clearly a student picture around that, but there's also a picture about that economy and what it means for the long term of a country like Northern Ireland. So I thought that was a really interesting kind of perspective. And similarly for Wales, as we know, Welsh students are incredibly mobile in moving across the border into England. So again, I thought that was an interesting take. I mean, for those many of us in the sector, we recognise that the Welsh government's probably got one of the strongest, most student-centric funding models and arrangements for where people are allowed to study. So I thought that was in a really interesting way that this data and this perspective could be used. And I'm going to be really keen to see what happens in Scotland. Of course, most Scots stay in Scotland as the supply of places are just about kept pace with demand. But we're just about to enter an area in Scotland where demand will outstrip supply. And so again, it'll be interesting to see, not least in the considerations around independence, what happens to the nature and culture of Scottish HE as it deals with the potential of more of its young people crossing the border south into England to study. So I thought it had these extra dimensions that were particularly fascinating around economics, culture, and the politics of the UK.
So the thing always with these reports is to think, okay, why now? Because I mean, the problem of poor quality data on where students come from and where graduates go to is a long-lasting one. We know how many students at the University of Reading come from Botswana. It's 10. We don't know, in public at least, how many come from Berkshire, which just seems to me like the wrong way around. We should know more about the kind of students that are attracted to a particular provider and where they come from. I think it all plays into the levelling up agenda. This perception in higher education that students come from all kinds of places. They go to their university in some random place in the UK and live effectively in a student enclave, and then they go off and get a job in London. And obviously for the majority of students, that's not the case. So what I think this report is trying to do is it's trying to make the case for two groups of students making a positive impact on their local area. And the first is commuter students, the ones that live in the place that they grew up and they commute to study, and then they come back and then they work and live and build a life in the place they grew up, thus hopefully levelling that place up. And the second group, the people who stay in the place that they were an undergraduate for the rest of their career and level up that place. It happens a lot, but you can only really see it. And this is an important point that this report makes, and in almost direct contradiction to another report on a similar topic that's coming out later this week, that this only works if you ignore the idea of graduate salary as the proxy for teacher quality, which has always been a bad idea and is something, if we're going to do serious policy at place, about place, we need to give up.
And I mean, I don't want to belabor this, but there's also going to be, just coming down the line in the next, you know, possibly months, policy aimed at refocusing funding towards outcomes. And there's some in the sector that would be on the very far end of the three of you that would say, would kind of quietly argue that we don't want too much data because the government might do some silly things with it.
The government has always done silly things with data. It always will do silly things with data. But the important point, and the point that I think that we all agree, is if it's open and transparent data, we can all do those same things and we can spell out exactly why they're silly and exactly where the problem is. Open data about the sector is really, really important. There's a lot of it hidden under the protection of autonomous providers, commercial in confidence, which arguably should not be. And there's a lot more stuff out there we should know about the sector, because ministers already know it and are making decisions based on it.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our various subscriptions. So thanks very much to Hilary, Andrew, DK and everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen. And until next week, stay wonky.